The U.S. reportedly considering the resumption of sales of offensive weapons to Saudi Arabia ahead of a visit by President Biden to Riyadh. The Red Cross describes the humanitarian situation in Yemen as unimaginable horror, saying that two-thirds of the population is deprived of basic health care. And China calling on Southeast Asian countries to avoid being used as code chess pieces by big powers. It's as many countries in the region are under pressure to take sides. Good everyone. Welcome to World News. Here in the Iranian capital, I'm your host, Behruz Najafi. Good to have you with us. The top story this hour, the U.S. reportedly considering the resumption of sale of offensive weapons to Riyadh, and that ahead of a visit by President Joe Biden to Riyadh this week. Discussions are reportedly at an early stage, and a decision hinges upon Saudi Arabia ending the war in Yemen. That was what Biden pledged during the early months of his presidency. But his administration has continued to sell weaponry to Saudi Arabia, which rights groups say were used to commit war crimes in Yemen. The U.S. is facing surging fuel prices and inflation. Washington and its Western allies have urged Riyadh to increase oil production to ease soaring prices that have taken a heavy toll on their economies.
After spending his first year and a half in office mostly trying to avoid deeper engagement in West Asia while prioritizing challenges at home and in other parts of the world such as China and Russia, President Biden seems to be making a slight shift towards dedicating more time and attention to West Asia. One of the main purposes of Joe Biden's visit is the so-called deepening of Israel's integration in the region and moving forward with the Abraham Accords, which is the main pillar of normalization deals with Israel. But the latter has raised questions regarding Biden's foreign policies, as Israel itself seems to be the source of the problem in the region, from its atrocities against Palestinians to its continuous attacks on Syria and its repeated threats against Iran.
Well, Israel has been the problem in the Middle East since their inception. And even before that, when they were under British occupation, Palestine was under British occupation, the Zionists were the cause of the problems in the Middle East, going back to the bombing of the King David Hotel. So Israel has been a really terrible neighbor for all of the surrounding countries to them. You mentioned Syria. Yes, I was in Syria several times when Israel was being the aggressor and actively bombing the Syrian people who've done nothing to them. They occupy Syrian territory in the Golan Heights. Israel has been just a terrible neighbor to everyone. They've been abusive of the Palestinian people. I've been to the Palestinian, what they call camps, refugee camps, and these are 70 years old now. These are not new. These are established communities that they refer to as camps. They drove the people off their land. They stole their land that they have no right and no claim to. So yes, Israel is the nexus of the problem in the Middle East.
Now, despite Israeli crimes, Washington seems to not only integrate the regime further into the region, it also aims to advance its plan to upgrade defense cooperation between Israel and the Arabs in the light of the Abraham Accords. Meanwhile, Iran has reiterated that normalization of relations between some Arab countries and Israel encourages and strengthens the regime to continue its crimes. President Ebrahim Raisi in April even compared friendship with Israel to keeping a snake in proximity.
Now, moving on with the rest of our news broadcast, a founding member of the Saudi opposition National Assembly Party has been killed in Lebanon. The party says that Tamania Al-Yami was assassinated in suspicious circumstances on Saturday. It's called for a just and transparent probe into his death, accusing Saudi authorities of failing to protect citizens seeking freedoms abroad. Yami was living in Lebanon since 2015. He helped found the National Assembly Party that was established in exile in 2020. It seeks an elected parliament in the autocratic Saudi Arabia. Hitman, acting under the Saudi Crown Prince, killed another dissident Jamal Khashoggi in Turkey in 2018. The International Committee of the Red Cross highlighting the worsening situation in Yemen. It says that mothers and babies there are facing unimaginable horror. The humanitarian organization says that two-thirds of the population is deprived of basic health care. It urges the world not to turn a blind eye to the plight of Yemenis, stressing that the people there should not be left alone. The Saudi-led war on Yemen has resulted in a dire humanitarian situation. The blockade has made the situation even worse, as the people are denied access to badly-needed medicines, food, and other basic necessities. UN figures released at the end of 2021 indicated that nearly 380,000 people had died since the beginning of the war in 2015. More than two-thirds of them were children under the age of five. China is urging Southeast Asian countries to avoid being used as chess pieces by big powers. The Chinese foreign minister says the region is at risk of being reshaped by geopolitical factors. Wang Yi says that many countries are under pressure to take sides. He underlined that regions should be protected from geopolitical calculations and coercion. He made a comment in a meeting of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, in Jakarta. Wang Yi also talked about Taiwan and warned about what he called illusions about separating the island from China. Beijing is locked in dispute with Washington over its military and diplomatic support for Taiwan. The South Korean military claims that North Korea has fired what appear to be multiple rocket launchers. South Korean Joint Chiefs of Staff says that the military detected flight trajectories possibly shot from North Korean artillery. It did not give further details, but said that the military is closely monitoring the situation. Tensions run high in the peninsula as Pyongyang has performed a series of missile tests this year. Recently, newly elected South Korean president warned against any provocative behavior by the North. Yoon Suk-yeol also talked about boosting military capabilities in close collaboration with the U.S. Pyongyang says its nuclear and missile programs are for self-defense in the face of U.S.-led threats. North Korea has also repeatedly denounced joint military drills by the U.S. and South Korea as invasion rehearsals. Frank Smith says the current South Korean president has taken a hard-line stance against North Korea.
North Korea is reported to have launched a couple of projectiles off of its east coast. Those come from the South Korean military. We're at a sort of period of tension here on the Korean Peninsula. The new South Korean president, Yoon Suk-yeol, has said that he's going to take a hard line with North Korea. This reverses the sort of engagement policy under previous president Moon Jae-in. Moon Jae-in had reached out to North Korea. He had generated negotiations with North Korea between the U.S. and the United States under previous President Donald Trump. Now we're seeing Yoon Suk-yeol again take a hard line with North Korea, and he also seeks to really strengthen the alliance between the U.S. and South Korea. Just now, just this week, South Korea welcomed six F-35 Joint Strike Fighters to participate in joint military exercises with South Korea. These types of exercises had been suspended and scaled down under the previous administration of Moon Jae-in. We're seeing a reversal of that policy and likely a response from North Korea that really kind of started earlier this year when everybody knew there was going to be an election here in South Korea and a likely shift in inter-Korean relations. We saw North Korea conduct a series of missile launches.
Now, protesters in Sri Lanka say that they are not leaving the presidential palace in the capital, Colombo, until the president actually steps down. People are still crowding outside the residence the day after storming it in anger. President Gotabaya Rajapaksa and the prime minister have fled with the navy. They say they will resign on Wednesday. Despite that, chaos is far from over. The South Asian nation is facing chronic food and fuel shortages and a galloping inflation, factors that brought the once relatively rich economy to its knees. Details of a transition of power and the shape-up of the next government are still not clear. Now we've talked to Chief of Sri Lanka's National Peace Council, Jahan Perera. He has taken part in rallies in Colombo and tells us what the demands of the Sri Lankan people are.
The mood is quite jubilant at this time, that as you would have seen footage of people going into the president's house and occupying it. They are taking a swim. They are touring it. Hopefully, they will not vandalize it. I'm very hopeful that that will not happen. But they have been able to breach that. And what this means is that it shows that the government is unable to resist the people's protest. And I'm hopeful that, now there is no constitutional way to force the president out. There's a very long process of impeachment. But also the people want the parliament also. They want the government in its entirety to go. The president plus the government, which is dominated by the president's party, they want them to go. And I have a feeling that that is going to happen now. And what we are moving towards is an all-party government, a small all-party government. Maybe it excludes the present the ruling family and the ministers of this present government, but it's going to be a small all-party government for a temporary period to try and get over the hump.
The Japanese government has called for a probe into the security loopholes in the assassination of former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Chief Cabinet Secretary Matsuno says the government has received a report suggesting fault in the security and guard system. Abe was fatally shot while speaking at a campaign event in the western city of Nara on Friday. The suspect is in custody and has confessed to assassinating Abe. The shooter mentioned Abe's alleged ties to a religious organization linked to the bankruptcy of his family. The killing has drawn condemnations from world leaders.
Hey everyone, Ali Reza here, back with another hashtag trending. On Friday morning, an unusual act of political violence shocked Japan and the whole world. Japan's longest-running modern leader, Shinzo Abe, was gunned down while delivering a campaign speech. Abe was assassinated by a 41-year-old man in a deed decried by the political establishment as an attack on democracy itself, shocking a country where guns are tightly controlled and political violence is almost unthinkable. Abe had been making a campaign speech outside a train station when two shots rang out. The assassination sent shockwaves throughout the world as post-war Japan prides itself in its orderly democracy. Our first tweet of the day comes from Marikong. Perhaps ordinary Japanese people, me included, worry a lot more about earthquakes than gun incidents. That's why the assassination of Mr. Abe was all the more shocking. We were naive in believing it can't happen here. Antoine Fletcher said, assassination is a grotesque act of cowardice. It should not be celebrated or encouraged. It is the murder of a man by a scoundrel unwilling to fight the armies who stand behind the assassinated. And over here, a comment by John Hernlund reads, the assassination of Shinzo Abe is a terrible tragedy. I want to express my condolences to all Japanese people who have worked hard to build and maintain a peaceful society without this kind of political violence. The assassin will not succeed in destroying these achievements. Tina has our next tweet, still in shock about former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's assassination. Violent crimes in Japan are very rare, which has truly rattled this country's sense of identity as a peaceful country. There are conflicting reports about the probable motives behind the assassination of Shinzo Abe, but investigative sources say that the suspect had a grudge against a specific organization, possibly a religious group, that he believed was linked to Abe. Our next comment says, before the assassination of Shinzo Abe, the most recent political assassination in Japan was in 1960, when a 17-year-old assassinated the leader of the Socialist Party with a sword. Julia Mio Inuma has our next comment. The assassination of Japanese leader Shinzo Abe rocked a country where strict firearms laws mean gun violence is almost unheard of, as a procession of mourners laid flowers near the site of the shooting to honor the country's longest-serving prime minister. Imran Khan tweeted, Shinzo Abe death. The murderer's heart was filled with hatred for the religious organization Shinzo Abe was associated with, the real reason behind the murder. Shinzo Abe's assassination. Know why the murderer killed Shinzo Abe, said to be hated the religious group. Messages of sympathy and shock poured in from around the world following the news of Abe's death, including ones from the neighboring Taiwan, China, and Russia, as well as from across Asia, Europe, and the Americas. Abe is best known for his Abenomics policy of aggressive monetary easing and fiscal spending. Our final batch of comments starts with a tweet by Alive. Whoever planned this already failed with Abe's assassination. This will further strengthen ideas of Abe about reconsidering the position of Japan post-1945 socially and militarily. This incident will speed up Japan's move towards a more anti-China and non-US-based security apparatus. Dr. Samuel Chapman has our next tweet. In the same way that mass shootings inspire copycats in America, I worry that Abe's assassination will do the same, but in other countries, not just Japan. It seems like it was a shocking, flagrant, egotistical attack, just like a mass shooting, so ripe for copying. Tom Boatman tweeted, apparently Yamagami, Abe's killer, was upset with Abe being an advocate of the cult-like Unification Church of Japan, Toitsu Kyokai, which Yamagami believed ruined his life. Japan's mainstream media is downplaying or simply not understanding this point. And our final comment comes from Pamela Valmont. Abe's assassination and Johnson's deposing are symptomatic of a much deeper plus more terrifying problem, approaching economic disaster in those countries who choose to implement sanctions against Russia. Winter cold, food rationing, plus shortages, plus no heating gas, plus petrol looming. That's a wrap for another Hashtag Trending.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Economic Divide.
The recent BRICS meeting hosted by China was a big event. Five countries not only pledged closer ties, but the Chinese president even encouraged other countries to join the bloc. Iran and Argentina applied, as BRICS turned into a grouping that is against the West and its financial grip, from monetary systems to trade. Hi, I'm Kavit Ahwai, and that is just one of the angles we'll be covering in this edition of Economic Divide. Coming up in the program, the BRICS countries, 40% of the world's population, 26% of the global economy, and $27.5 trillion in economic might. Next, we're going to take a look at the BRICS expansion. As we just mentioned, Iran and Argentina have applied for membership. Also looking at emerging market alternative to the West. That is something that the Chinese President Xi Jinping has encouraged. And finally, one of the other highlights of today's program, China and Russia to have leveled criticism against Western and the U.S. abuse of sanctions, the Ukraine crisis, a wake-up call, warning against expanding military alliances.
The BRICS group of nations have just held the 14th summit hosted by China. The group, which owes its name to the initials of its five member states, namely Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. BRICS nations have a combined population of 3.23 billion, and the combined GDP is more than $23 trillion. China has by far the largest economy in the BRICS grouping, accounting for more than 70% of the group's collective economic might. India accounts for about 13%, with Russia and Brazil each accounting for about 7%. The group has attained more significance following the war in Ukraine. The group is now seen as an emerging bulwark against U.S. global hegemonic ambitions. The group is trying to boost multilateral cooperation with non-Western styles, forms, and principles.
The New Development Bank is present there in a whole range of sectors. Now look, for example, our projects in wind energy in China, solar energy projects that we have in Brazil. We can say that the New Development Bank is contributing its share, closed the gap between the needs of infrastructure and sustainability in the emerging world and the resources that should be there available to finance these great projects.
The social media content on the BRICS countries was in some way even more than the actual media coverage, which shows how the West may be concerned about this grouping, which represents about 26% of the world's GDP. Well, first post is what the Chinese President Xi Jinping has said. Chinese President Xi Jinping on the 14th BRICS summit, it is important that BRICS countries support each other on issues concerning core interests, practice true multilateralism, safeguard justice, fairness, and solidarity, and reject hegemony, bullying, and division. Next up, BRICS countries certainly bring more positive, stabilizing, and constructive strength to the world. And a comparison was in this particular tweet, and stat-wise, it is apparent how BRICS outweighs the G7 group of countries, especially when it comes to the GDP. When you take a look at that, 26% versus 16%. And of course, the other stats speak for themselves in comparison. Next up, people are taking notice of the relevance of BRICS, given that the two countries have applied for membership, namely Iran and Argentina, which was covered in this tweet. So that shows that that's actually being recognized. And then moving on to this one, in the past 16 years, constantly have we heard that BRICS cannot be sustained. Time tells. And then it goes on to make a comparison between BRICS and security groupings. Here you can see BRICS standing for real multilateralism versus Cold War mentality, the security grouping. And then BRICS, how it focuses on global development versus the security groupings focus on exploiting developing countries. And of course, the other factors, as you see here. All right, so that was that comparison. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of the program, Glenn Diesen. He's a professor of international relations at the University of Southeastern Norway, who joins us. Glenn Diesen, welcome. When you take a look at the BRICS countries, they are a major economic, obviously, force, accounting for 40% of the world's population and 26% of the global economy. Now, China, by far, has the largest economy in this grouping, leading the way, accounting for more than 70% of it. But other countries are hoping to do better. Russia and Brazil, for example, they each account for 7%, and that may increase. Do you think that the BRICS countries is making a huge comeback, given the fact that you're looking at the Ukraine conflict and some of the geopolitical shifts worldwide that's taking place?
It's that the reason it's become so relevant, that it's come back into this fold, is because it's a response to the unipolar order, which is becoming more and more unfeasible, and also declining. So the unipolar order is effectively the international economy organized around the United States and also the collective West. So what we've been seeing over the past few years is simply that there's an emergence of new technologies which are not in the West. You know, across this BRICS country, you have new industries, new transportation corridors, there's new banks, there's more use of local currencies. So BRICS kind of represents, it's a way of organizing, if you will, this new diversified economic connectivities.
All right, let me introduce our next guest, Kim Do-joo. He is a political analyst, a senior fellow at Pangol Institution. He's also adjunct professor at Renmin University of China, and he joins us from Beijing, China. Kim Do-joo, welcome. The Chinese president has actually criticized the abuse of international sanctions, in particular, obviously making reference to the U.S. there. The Ukraine crisis, he also added, is a wake-up call for the world. And he also warned against these expanding military alliances, which is obviously a reference to NATO. What do you think about how BRICS used to be viewed, its contribution to the world economy, and how that has increased, and now with the Ukraine conflict, perhaps it's more relevant, and showing how alignments are shifting towards the East, perhaps, in some sense?
Well, I think, you know, as a group, as I said, the more represent this balancing power, I would say, to this current international system, which is dominated by Washington and Brussels. This is not balanced. This is not not fair, let's say, to the to this developing world. So there's a need, there's a long-term need to be fairly represented and to govern the international community or international global governance, let's say. Reform to the global governance is necessary. And with the rise of the developing world, I think, of course, they will defend their interests. They will have their voice heard.
It's time now for the InfoNews section of the program, where we take a look at economic news from around the world. Our first stop, Ghana. Ghana to make a U-turn and actually asked IMF for help for its economy. Ghana had refused to seek the IMF support to rescue an economy that's been crippled by the pandemic, rampant inflation, and also a depreciating currency. Protests have actually gone against the government, and they've spiraled in some places out of control, in particular inflation, to have taken place also to lead to the protests. The growth has been slowed to 3.3% year-on-year, and inflation a record 27.6% for the month of May. Next up, recession alarm bells. Asia's manufacturing has slowed. That has added to the global recession fears. Factory activity slowing or declining in countries like Japan, South Korea, and in Taiwan amidst supply disruptions and also rising costs. Now, China's manufacturing activity, here's the interesting part, expanded at its fastest pace in 13 months for the month of June as the lifting of COVID lockdowns sent factories racing to meet robust demand. Well, sharp economic slowdown risks in Europe, however, and then the United States, or maybe together at once, have reinforced fears of a global recession. So we can see how that is also gripping the world, what's happening in Europe and the States. Next up, we're going to take a look at ruble power. Yes, right, Russia demanding rubles for now grain exports. Moscow has expanded the list of commodities that must be paid for in the Russian currency. Obviously, the ruble is going to keep on doing better now that that has been added to the list. The Russian government has added also grain, sunflower oil, and it has extracted meal, a category that it calls, to the list of exports. Now, Russia is the world's largest wheat exporter and a major supplier of sunflower seeds. So still, the ramifications of the Ukraine conflict are at play. Our final stop in the U.S. and the stock markets there. Now, U.S. stocks are off to their worst start in over 50 years. The S&P 500, for example, ended first half of 2022 lower by 20.6%. Lots of losses there. And the Dow Jones has also been at the receiving end of the losses, down 15.3% this year, marking its worst first half performance since the year 1962, if you can believe that. Well, investors obviously are grappling with the risks of an economic downturn and also tighter monetary policy. Those are the four items that we picked.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for our in-depth section of the program. Well, when it comes to the BRICS group of countries, there is certainly a union between these countries in how, as one, they present a powerful economic force, which contributes a lot to the world economy as a result. There's no doubts about that, along with other groupings, blocs, and alliances. Well, the BRICS countries, well, the numbers speak for themselves. The world population, 41%. The world GDP, 24%. That's how much they contribute to the world GDP. That's almost a quarter of the world GDP. In terms of the global GDP, the value, $24.44 trillion. And in terms of the world trade, 16% there. Also, the global economic growth is 50% that it has contributed to. And this block of countries comprised of five countries, two to have applied for membership, Iran and Argentina. Goldman Sachs, the powerful brokerage firm out of the U.S., has said BRICS can become bigger than the G7 by the year 2035. That's not that far away. So that shows how powerful this grouping of countries is. All right, let's move on to the next grouping of countries. It's called the EAEU or the EAU, the Eurasia Economic Union. It is comprised of five countries, all of them in a single market, of which it has 184 million people in that market. And the combined GDP is $5 trillion. So this group of countries is something to take a note of. Now, moving on next, the SCO, Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Now, when you take a look at the SCO, this is the world's largest regional organization in terms of the numbers that it stands for of the countries. The land mass itself is pretty evident of that, 60% of Eurasia land mass. And in terms of the world population, it represents 40% of it. And when it comes to the global GDP, 30% is here. So Iran is also one of the countries because last year it became a permanent member. The last time that they met. All right, now let's move on to another grouping of countries. This grouping is actually also very important, and it's called the RCEP. What does it stand for? Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership Agreement, comprised of members with a world population of 15 members in total, the world population coming in at, 30%, 2.2 billion people, okay? So obviously a big grouping of countries in this particular block. The global GDP stands at second, and this is quite a bit since it's the largest grouping of countries, at $29.7 trillion. Okay? And therefore, it is no surprise that it holds the number one spot as being the world's largest trade bloc. That's right. And what is the most significant factor in all of these trading blocks, now that we've covered some of them? It's the fact that the U.S. is not a member. I repeat, not a member, which shows how the U.S. has, in some ways, isolated itself on the world stage when it comes to trade. Okay, let's bring back our guest for Q&A here. We have Glenn Deason, professor of international relations at the University of Southeastern Norway, rejoining us. Glenn Deason, welcome back. Iran, holding the world's second largest gas reserves, has applied for membership at the BRICS group of countries, along with Argentina. China has said that it wants other emerging economies to actually join this bloc, which was exclusively between the five countries, and would like to shape the BRICS agenda in line with its China-centric initiatives. No surprise there. Do you think Western policies and other systems emanating from the West have failed when it comes to why BRICS is now emerging so powerfully?
Well, yes, it has. I mean, if you look through history, liberal economic systems, so opening up trade and the cooperation between states, tend to organize under economic hegemons, so dominant economies, because they take on the role to administer the global economy, you know, because they have the technologies, the industries, the infrastructure, you know, bank and dominant currencies, and they can set the standards. So what we usually see is that the economic hegemon is to have an interest in creating trust in such a system, which is centered around them. So that is kind of the incentive. The problem is a hegemon in decline. It becomes more and more likely to abuse this administrative position in the economy. So it weaponizes this control over the economy to strike down against adversaries, to protect its declining position.
All right, let's have Kindo Zhu join us. He's a political analyst who joins us from Beijing in China. Kindo Zhu, welcome back. BRICS accounting for more than 40% of the world population and 26% of the global economy. You have other alliances also, such as the EAEU or RCEP in your part of the world, and also taking a look at the SCO, of which China is a major member of those alliances. But let's focus on BRICS in terms of its contribution. Countries like Russia and Brazil each accounting for about 7%, along with the contributions made by the other countries. It was once dismissed as a grouping, but now it has come back, and it is said to stand as a bulwark against the U.S. and the West. Do you see it that way?
Well, I think if you look at the past several years, you know, since the start, of the Trump regime, let's say 2016, you know, Trump launched the trade war, tech war, and a series of wars, quote unquote, not only against China but also against the Europeans and even its close neighbors like Canada and Mexico. So in that sense, you know, the U.S. has adopted a policy that is prioritize its domestic interests. Of course, U.S. has always been doing that, including this current U.S. government under Biden, for example. But for Trump, it's more standing out about the U.S., you know, America first policy. In that sense, you know, that's a huge, huge devastation to the global trade, let's say, the multipolar, multilateral system. For example, the WTO, the U.S. has more or less paralyzed this very important multilateral trade organization. And the U.S. has imposed the tariffs even today. You know, we are talking about billions and billions of Chinese goods. You know, this is a huge blow to this globalization.
The expanding influence of BRICS has encouraged other nations to join the economic and political bloc. Iran and Argentina have both applied for memberships. China has actually encouraged other countries, especially emerging nations, to join the bloc. In the case of Iran, it holds the world's second largest gas reserves. Its membership in BRICS would result in added values for both sides.
And leaders and foreign ministers reached a very important consensus to start promoting the discussions on the membership expansion issue. And we will start to identify the criteria and the principles, guidelines on this issue. China's intention is to keep it open, and we'd like to see that new members can come in. I do not have a timeline for this, but it's really based on the consensus of all BRICS countries.
BRICS countries have agreed that it is important to step up cooperation with other emerging markets and developing countries in order to improve the representation of the BRICS mechanism and make it loudly heard on major international issues. This will help to better rise up to challenges and to uphold the interests of emerging markets and developing countries.
منفتح وليس مغلق بأن لا يكون هناك تأثير سياسي على الاقتصاد بشكل مباشر.
Iran's potential membership to the BRICS group would be a severe blow to U.S. attempts to isolate Iran ever since the victory of the Islamic Republic. Washington has tried to ostracize Iran through various ways, including sanctions and threats. Iran has recently made great leaps in its foreign policy. It is now a member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and has applied for membership to the Eurasia Economic Union. Both of them are non-U.S.-led organizations that seek to counter the hegemony of the West. BRICS members, along with countries like Argentina and Iran, are a group of emerging economies that can evolve as an engine of global growth, which means that Western countries will be left behind as a result.
When it comes to the recent BRICS meeting, the role that this grouping plays in the world economy was highlighted again. But there was something very different about what this grouping represented as reflected through what the Chinese president said. What was another key highlight from Xi's four-point proposal on pursuing high-quality development of BRICS cooperation? These three were pretty significant. First, he said we need to speak out for equity and justice, to encourage the international community to practice true multilateralism, urging the world to reject the Cold War mentality and block confrontation, oppose unilateral sanctions and abusive sanctions. The need to pool strength for economic recovery, to step up macro policy coordination, to keep industrial and supply chains secure and unclogged, to build an open world economy, and to forestall and diffuse major risks and challenges in global development. And finally, to advocate sustainable and people-centered development, invest more in poverty alleviation, food, education, health, and so on, and promote the implementation of the UN's 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development. China has made it a point to set the stage in many of the previous topics discussed, and therefore it is no surprise that its governance model is what he believes is a successful one, which is non-Western.
The one impressed me most is the last few sentences made by President Xi, the emphasis of mutual benefit, cooperation, and win-win situation among the BRIC countries. This is very important because now the world is suffering because a BRIC country is trying to maintain its superpower.
This entry explains this fully. At BRIC Summit, China set stage to tout its governance model, where the bloc of emerging economies were praised for promoting non-Western styles, forms, and principles. It went on to say that boosting multilateral cooperation with non-Western styles, forms, and principle is of utmost importance, stressing the importance of the bloc at a time when the U.S. is pulling its Western allies to rebel against globalization.
As a developing country, Thailand looks forward to cooperating with BRICS countries, especially in terms of science and technology transfer and cooperation, technical training. I think BRICS has been very important in helping to promote cooperation, especially among emerging and developing countries.
And that does it for my segment.
In today's program, we brought you the relevance of BRICS, and I think we've done okay in terms of telling you how big a bloc that is, along with the other trading blocs and alliances, which show how much the world is shifting in terms of those alliances getting closer and doing trade amongst themselves. And we did mention that these blocs do not have the U.S. as a member, but there's a bigger reason for that, and that is the way that the U.S. has carried itself in its foreign policy endeavors. Sanctions to be one of them, of which the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, said that that is just counterproductive, especially for the world economy to grow, preventing that from happening. That is the main focus in what I want to leave you with, because obviously the U.S. is being left behind when it comes to the economics of the world and how it's preventing that to progress. That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you with us. From Mikavi Tahwe, it's goodbye until next time.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio. And you are listening to the program For Humanity, where we discuss human-related issues, and especially from an Islamic perspective. One of the most basic rights for a human being is the freedom of thought. Now, what is the freedom of thought, or so-called freedom of consciousness, or freedom of idea? Now, as an individual, as a human being, we all hold the right to have our ideology, to have our thinking, to have our beliefs, to have our viewpoints, our thoughts, and independently, without being forced to think elsewise. So I am free to think in aspects of, when, in terms of my beliefs, in terms of my political belief, in terms of my economical belief, in terms of my social belief, in terms of my even scientific belief. Every human being should have this basic right to think for himself and to be free of other interventions. I mean, I can't make this any more basic. And as human beings, we understand this from the bottom of our bellies, that this is our right, the right of every human being. However, is that the case now in our modern world, if we look at it? Of course not. Now, this topic of the freedom of thought and freedom of consciousness and the freedom of idea, it's constantly under attack, and especially by the media, where we are not being able to form our own thinking, or rather, if we have formed of our own thinking, it is constantly under attack, which violates the human rights in this sense. So it is the freedom of thought is basically the fundamental and the most basic pillar of freedoms, of rights, at least, if we can say that. So it is constantly required in every aspect of my life. So when I use my own mechanism, when I use my own social media, for example, mechanism, when I use the media in general, the mechanism of media, in order to brainwash societies, in order to brainwash people, in order to install in them my own ideology, that's a direct violation towards human rights. And this is now is being done systematic. It's been done by some oppressive systems in the world, even though these systems, they clothe themselves with the term of freedom or the term of human rights or the term of trying to give people justice and what have you. But the reality of them, they are very oppressive in their nature in terms of violating one's mind and violating one's thinking and trying to deprive him and steal everything from him. Now, this is, to begin with, is not human, and second, is not realistic or Islamic or religious in any shape or form, because man, doesn't matter what he wants to think, he has the right to think that. Now, we can discuss, we can debate, but he has the right to form his own beliefs and his own thinking, and we have to agree with him. Now, let us take a short break, and then we will continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. Before the break, we were saying that as human beings, we have the right to form our own beliefs and our own thinking, our own point of view in all aspects of life. And no one should have the right to take that from me. Now, sometimes these thoughts and these ideas and these ideologies that I hold, sometimes they are in my brain, in my thoughts, which I'm sure no one says to me, you can't think that, I can think wherever I want. But sometimes, when I want to put my thoughts into words, either written or verbal, then I face the music, as we say. So many books get banned. Many books are not allowed to be published because they hold an ideology that is different to that of my enemies or different to those who don't like it to be printed. Now, where's the freedom of thought in that? Now, obviously, some might say, well, yeah, but there are books that are destructive. They're harmful to humanity. They're harmful to human beings. They're harmful to the beliefs of people. Obviously. I mean, we're not talking into a specific cases. So in terms of being specific, yes, there are very destructive mentalities. I can't have such mentalities run wild within humanity because there are books written by Muslims and non-Muslims alike. Which have very destructive ideology and towards the youth, towards people in general. But I'm talking about other instances where I am not violating man's right, at least to live or to live a happy life. I'm just expressing my views, at least if it's done from an Islamic perspective, if I'm trying to say my thoughts of my belief themselves. For example, Islam forbids homosexuality. Now, homosexuality is now very accepted in all parts of the world, and it's the norm now, and it's even blessed by the church. But as a Muslim, if I want to say, well, no, actually, that's wrong. I don't practice such a thing, and I hate such a practice, and I stand against such a practice. Now, this is my own thinking. This is my own beliefs. Am I allowed to do that now in the Western countries? Of course not. That will be considered violation of the rights of others, which is insane, insanity. So I cannot express my views anymore. In terms of I want to speak my own views in terms of saying, okay, these people, for example, this transgender community now in the Western country, if I say they're wrong in what they're doing by trying to eliminate the he and the she and the it and what have you, if I want to say, well, they're not right in this regard, now I am under attack. So you can see that I am just trying to lay the foundation, inshallah, for episodes to come. But we can see that the thinking of people now is under attack. You're not allowed to be a free thinker. And even if you are a free thinker, you're constantly being, your thinking being manipulated by the media, by social media, by the superpowers, and people now, they only believe what they see, what they've been told. They're not being allowed to be free thinkers, to be able to form their own point of view. It's constantly being manipulated by other systems, which violates the rights of people themselves. So we will leave it up to here. And we will continue this topic in other episodes. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi.
محمد وآله.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.